emails can be sent back to us in real time for commentary. We have the kind of scribes and tech table over here with, for those who have been to other meetings, some familiar faces, Andrew McLaughlin, Ben Edelman, and Wendy Seltzer, working the machines. Yes? Why don't we start with Kim Isbell? She's a student here and is working on the study. I see Molly, too. Molly, Molly Schaefer Van Howling, whom all of you know as Molly, is an advisor to ICANN and a fellow of the Berkman Center. Andrew McLaughlin, Ben Edelman, and Wendy Seltzer. Is there anybody else I'm... And Tamar Frankel, who is a fellow of the Berkman Center and somebody who may be recognized as having chaired the IFWP. If you don't know what that means, you soon will. So with that, then, we'll start the day. You'll see there's an agenda. We have a morning panel starting momentarily. This includes, we tried to get as many people from membership organizations, whether related to the internet or not, as we could. As it shook out, a number are at least tech-related organizations. As we conduct the study, we'll certainly be trying to be in touch with all sorts of membership organizations to pose to them the issues that are confronting ICANN and see how they have solved them or not, and if there are any lessons we can draw from it. And those are the sorts of questions we'll be asking the morning panel as soon as we get it started. After that, we'll have some more discussion. We'll have a chance. We put up three what we call straw person or straw people models. These straw models are meant to get a little bit specific and have some ideas on the table. There they are right there for how ICANN could work. These are by no means meant to be exclusive, but a chance to then apply whatever lessons we may learn this morning to these models to see how they might evolve and adapt to be better. We then have a free lunch. There is such a thing, although not to Berkman Center. I assume we will be billed for it, but you will not. So there's a free lunch to be had downstairs. Then we have breakout sessions, and Austin North, West, and East are remarkably intuitively in Austin Hall. They are right downstairs. And these breakout rooms, which you'll see are somewhat cavernous given the number of people we have here, but we can sort of huddle at the front of the respective rooms and perhaps get some work done on the three questions that you'll see listed on the agenda for those sessions. Then we have a presentation of the results back in here, particularly important since I don't think we have real audio streaming from the rooms downstairs. And then an afternoon panel meant to pull it all together with some people whom we think can think helpfully about this, again, who may or may not be particularly into the domain name issues as we see them. And you'll also notice two microphones here. And after we kind of get into a rhythm with the panels between and among the panelists and the moderators, we expect to open it up for some kind of participation with the audience. So that said, why don't we get started? If I could call the people whose names appear on the cards here, maybe I should even go around and read them if that would be helpful. Those who know that they're on the morning panel might want to come up. Hearn, Chris Morgan, Fred Wertheimer, Scott Bradner, Shayana Smith, Teresa Amato, and Bob Erickson. I believe in the back of the briefing books you'll see biographies on the featured people today. But also, as you settle in, maybe we could just go from closest to me down, and I'd just be delighted to hear who you are, what organization you represent, and in the barest terms, something about your membership. How big is it? Who does it comprise? How big might it ultimately be someday? That kind of thing. So, Mitchell.
Good morning. My name is... Good morning. My name is Mitchell Ahern. I'm chairman of the Association of Internet Professionals. Supposed to say what again? I'm not attending.
Membership organization?
Oh, yes, yes. We are a membership organization. Professional people in the internet industry, writ very large, whether they be design, technical, or business people, or more commonly, assortment of all three living in the same person. We're about 8,000 members at this point, 100 corporate members. We're a chapter-based organization. We try to take people out of the virtual space and put them in real space. 30 chapters in the U.S. and internationally, with a number of chapters forming up worldwide. So that's me. I'm also a webmaster for Eastern Acoustic Works during my day job.
And what's the mission of your organization?
Our mission is to promote, edify, educate, and bring together members of the profession of internet industry. I mean, I think there's a real sense that our goal is to promote the idea that there is, in fact, such a thing as an internet professional, and that that person has a distinct suite of concerns and issues, and try to bring to the our individual and corporate members the kind of support that they need to further their career and to, you know, to further the sense of there being such a thing as an internet career, and to further that's you know, the character of that and the perception of that in the world and industry at large. The AIP has existed for about 2 years, and it came together out of Webmasters Guild, of which I was the vice president, the IDA, Internet Developers Association, and the ISIP. And that took place over about a year's time. And so the constituent organizations go back 3 or 4 years beyond that.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Morgan, and I'm a consultant to the ACM, which is the Association for Computing Machinery. I'm also on the Membership Activities Board and do a variety of perform a variety of functions for the ACM. We're now 51 years old, and we are, I believe, the world's largest professional and educational computer society in the world, with 60,000 members in the United States and an additional 20,000 members in the rest of the world. We have hundreds of local chapters around the world. We have 36 special interest groups that cover the entire field of computing, including the internet. Many, many of our members are very active in the internet, and in fact many were involved in the creation of the internet. Vince Cerf, for example, is an ACM member, and I could go on and on. But we, our charter is primarily to disseminate technical information to professional people in industry and educators, students around the world. We also have a public policy committee in Washington that works on issues related to the internet and other issues of public interest.
And do your members elect your board?
The members, yes. The members elect the officers and the board.
Right.
Good morning. I'm Fred Wertheimer. I was president for 14 years of an organization named Common Cause. It's a membership organization of about 250,000 individuals. With a national organization, 50 state organizations. While I was there, a 60-member board that met four times a year. Common Cause works on issues of governance, the rules, process, campaign finance laws, ethics laws, an agenda that focuses on the way government functions. I am now president of Democracy 21. This is a public policy organization that also works on the campaign finance issue, but is focused additionally on the issue of how the internet can be used to strengthen and advance the political process in this country and generally. Democracy 21 is a non-membership organization. It has a 5-member board that meets one time a year. Now, you can or cannot draw implications from what I've learned about membership from these definitions. I wouldn't, but there are different ways to function.
Is there such a thing as too much democracy in your view?
No, there isn't. The question, however, is defining what democracy is and how it functions. That's a little, that gets rather controversial, as we all know.
See. Scott?
I'm Scott Bradner from the Internet Society, a trustee of the Internet Society. The Internet Society is a 6 or 7 year old organization. I wasn't there at the creation, but have been on the board now for just about 4 years. The mission statement, and I will read it verbatim, to assure beneficial open evolution of the global internet and its related internetworking technologies through leadership in standards, issues, and education. The Internet Society serves as a legal umbrella and provides some financial support to the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force Standards Organization. It also runs an annual series of workshops, mostly for folks from developing countries, trying to provide education for those who will bring the internet to places where it's not currently. It's about 6,800 members currently, individual members. There's also 153 organizational members. Board is elected from the individual members. The organizational members don't vote in the board election. There are chapters around the world. I forget how many there are now, but it's in the 20 to 30 range of chapters, and there's more all the time. I think that's about it.
Great, thanks.
My name is Shauna Smith. I'm from the International Trademark Association. INTA is about 120 years old. It is an association made up of trademark owners, law firms servicing the trademark industry, trademark service firms, search firms, things like that. It as well can have individual members, but presently we have no members who are individuals.
Is that nobody has signed up, or they're not allowed to sign up?
They are allowed to sign up. They're anyone who owns a trademark.
And just no one has signed up?
I was thinking of trademarking my name.
Could have brought some forms with you today or something.
The INTA annual membership fees are actually different depending on which membership class you're in.
How much for the members, of which there are none?
The individual members would be trademark owners, and that would be about $800 a year. And that's the highest, actually. It goes down from there. Yes, there's the way that we've set up the membership type, there are trademark owners, which are really the important members who are the only voting members. And then the law firms and service firms are called associate members, and they do not vote, but they will be heard at.
So you have all associate members and no members?
No, we have. Yeah,
ah.
They're just corporations.
Coca-Cola makes it.
Absolutely, if they paid the $800.
Right, now, if anybody has to go make a phone call, we do that. Okay, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Teresa Amato. I'm the founder and executive director of the Citizen Advocacy Center. It's a community-based organization in the suburbs of Illinois, Elmhurst, Illinois. And our mission, or we're dedicated to building democracy in the 21st century, or for the 21st century, by developing the public's capacities, resources, and institutions for self-governance. We are a 501c3 corporation like ICANN, and we are non-membership. We do have a board of directors and an advisory committee, and we help set up other nonprofits and advise on their membership structures. We're also specialized in democratic protocols, monitoring local governments, and in my former life, I was the director of the Freedom of Information Clearinghouse and litigated anti-government secrecy types of cases.
And we definitely have a lot of questions for you. We could use your expertise. Our last person is not necessarily from a membership organization, administratively speaking, but is a member of such an organization. Is that right, Mr. Erickson?
Yes. My name is Bob Erickson. I work at a local town, Watertown, right next to Cambridge. I work in the MIS department. Our town is a member of the Mass Municipal Association, which is an organization which encompasses essentially all of the 351 cities and towns in Massachusetts. I might have got off on the wrong foot because I did raise my hand stating that I'm not immersed in domain names, et cetera, right away. Perhaps I will be in the future. But I think perhaps I can give a perspective, because I know the towns in Massachusetts more and more are getting into the Internet, and there's an extreme amount of interest in it, web pages, and I think there might be quite a bit of interest in town membership, et cetera.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us. Before I ask any questions of the panel, I want to just highlight something right now, which is I asked Fred a question, is there such a thing as too much democracy? Somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but hoping to elicit an interesting answer, which it certainly did. And I could swear I actually heard a hiss emerge from somewhere in the room. Now, I don't mean to cast aspersions upon the steam vent system that heats the room, but if it happened not to be from that, I'd like to encourage those here to understand that we are in an academic environment, we're in a collegial environment, and I hope that, first, the asking of a question should not be taken to be a presupposition about the asker's view of the answer, and secondly, even if it did, perhaps you could start writing a flame email for sending immediately following this session, but at least while within the confines of this room, I'd like to ask that views not be reacted to in such a manner, if that's okay. So I'd rather not get into a meta discussion about the rules. I'd just rather make them clear. You're in our home right now, and these are our house rules, if that's okay. Thanks. So with that said, Mitch, you have both you and Chris are from organizations of internet professionals. Do you have any distinct bar as to who is a professional and who is not? If I come forward and it turns out I know nothing about the Internet but want to join your organization, is that okay?
We have a class membership in our organization, associate member, which is a non-voting membership, that is appropriate for someone who is not an Internet professional. We have a procedure which a peer review procedure that vets whether or not members are, you know, truly professional or professional wannabes, I guess. I will, however, admit that that procedure is not as fully functional as one would like. The real dividing line at this point is whether or not they paid their dues.
So if I know nothing about the Internet, which I credit, and I come forward and want to join not as an associate but as a full member, so long as I pay the dues, it's not as if there's some test I have to take or...
Well, I mean, theoretically, there is a test. Theoretically, you're submit references to, along with your application of your professional work, and people who are already members review that and decide whether or not that work is... can be considered professional.
Have you ever disqualified any members or refused to enlist one after checking references?
There have been some cases, I believe. But as I say, that procedure, since we're a chapter-based organization, that procedure happens with different levels of efficiency from chapter to chapter.
And if somebody is turned away or disqualified, how do they, should they want to appeal that, how do they do that?
Can be appealed to the board. But it hasn't actually happened that an appeal has gotten to the board yet, so...
That was an interesting way of phrasing it. There maybe have been appeals launched, but they've landed short of the board.
It's entirely possible. But at this point, if someone really wants to pay money and join the organization, there's precious little reason for them to want to imitate being a professional. There's not a lot, enough in the organization that you need to fake your way in, if you know what I mean. It's an organization for professionals, and if you're an internet professional, there's stuff there for you to use. If
right.
you're not an internet professional, there's not really that much of a reason for you to want to imitate one.
Right.
And, in this industry, if you can do a good enough imitation, you are a professional.
The touring thing.
Chris, does it work the same way with ACM?
Essentially, yes. We don't have a litmus test, but practically speaking, the level of the material that we offer is really only going to be of primary interest to people who are professionals, who have the educational background or the training to take advantage of what we offer. We do offer non-voting memberships to students at a significant discount, and that is one area where we reach out. We also have group memberships for people, especially in developing and third world countries, where we offer our services at a deep discount.
So it's interesting to think that to the extent that your organization doesn't have crown jewels within, you don't have the same sense of a threat of capture of the organization. I suppose there's always the possibility of political infighting, and it'd be interesting to hear tales, if you have them, of floor fights among the membership or a particular issue that divided the organization. People already within it felt possessive enough of the organization and a claim to its spirit that they wanted to fight for it. But you're saying, short of that, the idea of people who aren't really members wanting to kind of charge the gate and just take over the show isn't something realistically on the table for your organizations.
I would have to say no, only because of the nature of the organization. We're somewhat of a different animal from this organization in that we are primarily disseminators of information. Now, we do take stands on public policy issues, but that, again, is a little different from the actual implementation, which is what you're
right.
involved in.
Has anybody on the panel had any instance in which there's been a sudden spike in membership registrations, with the idea being perhaps they're coming or being driven by a single source or collection of interests with the intention of having some capture of the organization or changing its direction? We'd wanted to have somebody actually from the National Rifle Association here today to talk about various floor fights, but Charlton Heston was unavailable. How about then internally? I mean, why don't we just cut right to it? Are there instances of internal fights for which the membership is the way that the fight gets expressed, how many votes you have at the end of the day among the members?
We had an issue relating to this when Webmasters Guild announced that it was going to be merging with the Association of Internet Professionals a year or so ago. The several chapters took this as a very betraying act. They were most upset with the shift in, or the perceived shift in organizational goals and the perceived, you know, loss of benefits that joining AIP would bring, which actually struck me as most peculiar, since the reason that we were merging Webmasters Guild with AIP was that we had no level of benefits to bring to the individual member at the time. And we lost one or two chapters who decided that rather than become an official chapter of the new organization, AIP, they were going to split off and become their own freestanding city-based user group, internet user group, and they remain so today. And a couple of other chapters decided that after a lot of soul searching that they'd stay on, but we had to make concessions to them to allow them an enhanced sense of webmaster identity. So yes, it was quite a harsh struggle in some respects, because people were very passionate in places that you least expected them to be.
Common Cause had a number of internal fights over governance. Those fights break down into different categories. Sometimes the fights over governance have to do with what's the fairest and most appropriate governance structure for an organization. Sometimes the fights are fights over policy fought out in terms of governance grounds. And sometimes, maybe most often, they're fights over power, who is going to exercise power. The fights were almost always between the leadership of the organization and activists, or among activists, and never in terms of the general membership. And in that context, the fights would tend to play out over different aspects of governance that in part were governance, but often went to the distribution of money within the organization and to the policy positions the organization was taking. And we found that governance, ongoing governance battles, can be extraordinarily time-consuming, and can have an organization wind up spending too much of its time focused on its own internal structure as opposed to its larger mission. Now, I'm not saying that happened on an extended basis, and some of the governance fights were quite legitimate. Other governance fights were the same fights we had just had being refought because the people who had not prevailed wanted another chance. So, and if you happen to be an organization whose mission is governance, you are susceptible to extraordinary internal pressures in fights about your own governance, and you're subject to being appropriately sensitive, insensitive, and oversensitive.
What, before Scott tells his story, what in your mind defines an activist? You talked about the activists and the general membership.
Time. Activists are people who, the general membership, we were a membership-structured organization. The members paid an annual dues.
How much were the dues?
The annual dues was $25 a year. Some members made additional contributions. Part of the membership, that's all they did. Other members were engaged in activities like writing letters to their elected officials. Other members were active as volunteers at the state level or more active in the national organization. But activists, to me, are people who have who put in more time than the general member, are more engaged, and bring with them, obviously, more intensity.
I can imagine two visions of activists and how they relate to the general members. One vision says, once you're a member, it entitles you to be active. Those who have the passion and the time to devote to something, the whole point is that they can do so and that they then, therefore, earn a disproportionate relative to what might happen if you just called a simple vote of the membership way of steering the affairs of the organization. The other vision, of course, would be, well, now you just have people who happen to have the time to do it to be able to turn the organization away from what the will of its quieter majority might want.
Yeah, and you would have both kinds. Now, we wanted activists. Activists were very important to us. We were looking for people to put in more time and more energy into what we were doing. And with activism, you get activism of all kinds, including activism over your internal system and the decisions that are made and who's making them and why they're making them. I mean, the one thing that strikes me here is in almost any organization, there is concern about the leadership and the self-selection of leadership and the self-continuation of leadership. In the structure you're looking at, I am at least, you know, as a totally uninvolved, I'm kind of struck by the potential questions that exist for self-selected membership that you potentially are going to have. Because I am an internet user. I am not going to be a member. I am going to have interests in the decisions you make. Now,
you're not going to be a member because...
It's because I have other things to do.
You have other things to do. Even if it meant filling out a form, likely it'll fall.
I'm unlikely to be a member, but even if I was, most internet users in the world are not going to be members of this organization.
Right.
So to the extent that people are concerned about a self-selected leadership making decisions and perpetuating their views in some unaccountable form, I think you have to be concerned as you build this structure about a self-selected membership exercising, you know, given my choice, I might be more interested in the self-selected leadership than the self-selected membership representing me. So, I mean, I just,
I think that's part of what you have to think through in figuring out this structure.
So do you have any quick thoughts on how to, assuming that's the problem, how would you structure a membership to buffer it?
I don't have quick thoughts, but I do think that if you, one, membership is one way of promoting accountability for an organization. And it's a very important way if it's deciding who the organization's leaders are. There are other forms of accountability. Sometimes that can be more effective or supplementary in terms of influencing the process. And in a world like this, one of the greatest accountabilities is public information. That can create enormous pressure on the leadership of this organization if someone is out there providing information which, through its own force, basically shows going in the wrong direction. So one might think that other forms of accountability and other protections as well as a membership should be part of the mix.
I have a follow-up thought on Fred's comment and, about being concerned about a self-perpetuating organization with little accountability to the general internet user. And one way to avoid that would be to have very low barriers or low entrance barriers or criteria for just general membership, and to devise a mechanism where you allow members to directly propose policy that has to be voted up or down by the self-perpetuating board.
Hmm. Scott, you've been wanting to say something.
The Internet Society has had two cases where there's been some level of internal disagreement. One was over some provisions in the initial bylaws that were put in to ensure some level of stability, or at least this was what the excuse was. And there was a great deal of disagreement over those specific aspects of, in this case, it was three board members that were in perpetuity, that the organizations could keep selecting, there'd be no election for them and everything else. And there was a great deal of dissension amongst the members and in this case also with the Internet, between the Internet Society and the IETF. And this took about a year and a half to work out, and it did take a great deal of energy and was quite painful. The other case was one where a particular chapter had, or more particularly the leadership of the chapter, had taken positions within a country, this was a country chapter, taking positions within the country to do with internet censorship and the like, which were counter to the ISOC mission statement and the ISOC general direction. And after considerable pain, we decertified the chapter, which was a difficult thing to do. And the board decertified the chapter. Not the individuals within the chapter, because they were ISOC members directly, but the chapter as an a subsidiary organization, as a related to ISOC organization. And one of the upshots of that was the chapter head ran for the board the next year. He didn't make the board, but that this was a reasonable response to the event, to the events.
When his chapter was decertified, he was allowed to remain a member of ISOC.
Well, we do not decertify members. But the chapter has all chapters have their own bylaws, and in the bylaws, which have to be approved by the ISOC, actually vice president for chapters, it says that they won't take positions which run counter to the fundamental principles that the ISOC has articulated. And this particular chapter had done so.
One interesting thing, the bracket, it looks like at least three of the organizations here have chapters as a unit of control or membership within the organization.
Well, note that the chapter is not a control of membership. It's a way for local interest groups to be focusing on local issues, rather than having everything being done at the national, at the international level. That if there's some particular interest in the New York City area, the New York City chapter can worry about that, have local meetings. It provides a little bit better understanding of the local climate.
And it might also help provide a New York voice upwards in the organization to say that these are the interests of, say, New York.
That it does.
I would also add that just from a logistical standpoint, especially when you get up to 80,000 members, as we have, we are decentralized as a matter of course. And very few
the people in the organization can get to a lot of international meetings. So instead they will gravitate to whatever is close by, namely the local chapters. This gets into the whole issue of decentralization and how you manage a very, very diverse, decentralized group of members. And we've spent a lot of time thinking about that and wrestling with that, and I'd be happy to go into that at the appropriate time. But you know, the local chapters are there to give people some way to interact with other members and also to talk about local issues, but it's more than just that in our case.
One problem I can right now is reconciling the idea of an at-large membership, making it as flat as possible so as not to have to designate one interest versus another and then who gets what number of votes or representation, and at the same time such a strong imperative to have balanced international representation at some level. And I've, of all the discussions I've seen, I have yet to hear anybody thinking of ICANN with respect to chapters of ICANN, quite possibly because it's a really bad idea, but it also might be one worth batting around. Yeah, down here.
I was just wondering, someone mentioned dues. I know in some of the organizations I've participated in, there's perhaps three or four levels, if there may be a perception, perhaps reality, that some people may want to be activists, but they can afford $25 for a membership. And if they see a corporate membership or whatever it's going to be, that even if they want to partake and they want to have more of a voice and they can volunteer time, their clout will not be the same as perhaps some type of corporate membership or a larger, which contributes more money but does not put in the time. Is that, I don't know if that's a disconnect there. Perhaps it might.
No, I think it's definitely, again, another issue on the table, how to reconcile individual interests with corporate interests generically, organizations.
And also, if you talk about ownership, to make people feel, yeah, I'm making a difference, I can't contribute as much perhaps as someone else, but you know, I'm there every day. And then if, in fact, that goes on for a period of time, they're not getting perhaps any positive feedback or feeling they're making a difference, they drop out, and the people they really rely on to make a difference aren't there, and the corporate membership can contribute, but they don't participate nearly as much.
Right. I'd like to give everybody sort of a chance to get into this, but to keep it streaming over the real server properly, I think we need to have it on the microphones. And if you can identify yourself.
I'm just curious about what Scott said about the structure of ISOC. You have individual members and they vote. What do the corporate members do? Just send money?
We hope they send lots of money.
Yeah.
Corporate memberships are the range of price from raising annual fee from about $1,000 to $50,000, with the $50,000 ones being very, very supportive, and there's about a dozen of them. Individual members, the price for individual membership is typically $35 a year, but reduced price for students and for what we call qualified countries, which is $12 for folks in places where $35 is a lot of money. $12 is still a lot of money, but it turns out that it costs in the range of $10 to $12 a year to actually service a member, where they don't get a copy of the physical publication, where we're just doing the balloting and the voting and the like. But yes, the individual members are the ones that vote, whether they're $12 members or you can spend $500 on individual membership if you want to be supportive. But they are the ones that vote. The individual members vote. The corporate members form an advisory council, which does provide input into the board. Officers of the advisory council sit with the board, except for except for personnel issues. But the outside board meetings are open anyway. But specifically, the officers of the advisory council are on the board mailing list, and act as part of the board, even though they don't have a vote in board matters. So the corporate members get their voice through their representatives, but it's a discussionary voice. It's not a voting voice.
Yeah. I have a question and also a
a question and also a what?
I thought a concern.
Okay.
And the concern is, I thought it was very good, John, that you raised the issue of the crown jewels, and the crown jewels have to do with both the controlling interests in the internet, which have to do with the central functions of the 4.3 billion IP numbers. They have to do with the domain names. They have to do with the root service system. They have to do with determining the protocols. And they have to do with other matters that are both tremendously lucrative and also have controlling interest in the internet. I don't know how much any of the people up there have any concept
that this... Well, we got some sense of it from Mitchell and Chris when they were saying, you guys may have a very different experience than we do, worried about a sudden influx of new members or something, seeking control of the organization.
Okay, but I'm not aware of, as far as most ACM or others, of any of them owning public assets.
Agreed.
That are very important, and that I guess the relevant experience in a very minor way seems to be the Internet Society, and what was that initial battle all about? Because here, in fact, there are two things. One, you're talking about membership, but there are two real questions, I thought, and that has to do with power in the organization. The mission statement says nothing about e-commerce. And yet when I've submitted papers for social and spreading access, there's no clue.
There's the papers to ISOC.
To the ISOC.
I see.
Right, that there's, and went to the sessions and heard the sessions and how vitally those were needed. There was no means into the organization of even having those issues considered, and we wouldn't be in this mess right now if there were. So where does the power lie? What was that initial battle about? Because I thought it had to do with government.
So,
and let me say, just clarify.
Sure.
I thought the real issue here is that the U.S. government up to now has provided, to greater or lesser degree, more recently lesser, a way to protect these central functions. That protection is crucial for the internet. Where is the looking at what has been that protection, and how it's provided it, and how something as with the strength of a government
right.
is needed to do that, versus we're talking about who's running some organization. We're not talking about some organization. We're talking about a vital public resource for people all over the world.
Understood.
And the Internet Society, I think, is the only one really relevant.
Right.
And that's dealing with some very minor aspect of that. And that, my sense, has totally failed, that e-commerce has taken it over. The public questions have been wiped out. And so, and the initial battle, it just seems to me you really have an obligation to tell us a lot more about that.
So before...
Talking.
Before I... Before I let Scott, and I saw Mitchell had a thought too to share, let me ask you something, Rhonda. You just told a brief story about being a member of ISOC.
I'm not a member, a submitter of papers.
You submitted papers to ISOC.
But there was someone who was a member, in fact, early
okay.
on as well, that initial member.
So you submitted a paper,
can
you
I
weren't
clear?
A member. You felt as if the paper was not properly considered or injected into the process. What piece of membership could you think of? And I understand your answer may be there is no membership conceivable that properly protects the functions you think ICANN is to be assigned to do. And as a result, ICANN shouldn't exist and the government should just do it. But short of that, is there any feature of membership you can think of that, to your mind, would protect your ability to submit the paper and get it duly considered?
Right, that's very important because
yeah,
you're saying
you
government is one side, ICANN is the other. And I'm saying my experience is exactly the opposite, that I fought very hard against the U.S. government to do things I think it should do.
Yes.
But when there's a government, there's some ability to, for the citizen, which I think has much more relevance to the internet than any membership, that the citizen has an ability to say, I have the right to fight you, I have the right to be heard, and you have an obligation to protect something in the public interest.
Now, can you imagine?
And that's a government.
Right, I understand.
What you're talking about is wiping out that relationship, putting me
yes.
with the private sector,
yes.
and my experience has been I was teaching in a situation where the private sector, the public sector were together.
Yes.
The public sector ran the show. It took me 3 years to find out that the government was responsible because it was hidden.
Yes.
But in fact, that it was a governmental obligation, which my sense is the protection of these are governmental because they're
right.
public property.
Okay, Rhonda, let me, please. I know you get momentum going, and it certainly goes. My question is...
Jonathan, there's a fundamental broken piece in this discussion. And that is that, Rhonda, you submitted papers to a conference with a program committee. The program committee made choices on those papers. It was not policy decisions on the board. It was not policy decisions on the Internet Society. Internet Society, when it runs a conference just like anybody else does. It picks a program chair and picks people on the program, and they pick people for program committee. There was no policy decision one way or the other relative to your papers, okay. Period.
So may I suggest that... you may not. May I please have... I'm the moderator. Please, Rhonda. Rhonda, please. May I suggest that the next 40 minutes could be spent figuring out whether the particular incident that you now both have, he has said and she has said, he said, she said, whether that particular incident was resolved properly. But I, in fact, don't even suggest, I say that we will not spend the next 40 minutes discussing whether your paper was properly presented or accepted or considered at a particular ISOC program committee. We will focus on membership issues, and indeed, this very conference will be an example of the problems latent when people have strong views, want to have them heard or counter-heard, and yet we have a big group of people trying to get, quote-unquote, something done, and you have to balance the efficiency of getting something done with the clear passion of saying, no, there's something more important than that. So I'm now taking some license to resolve it and ask Mitchell, you had something you'd wanted to say. Sorry to jump it in your lap, but...
Yes. I think there is actually a good point in Rhonda's...
Yes, I know. I thought so, too. But please, don't get me wrong. I have very good points there. I'm doing my best to elicit them.
We preface this by the statement that I can exist.
Right.
And so we're not going to examine that.
Right, even though it may be worth examining. Don't get us wrong. It might be worth examining, but we will not...
And in fact, it has a given set of responsibilities.
Right.
That we've all looked at.
Right.
But there is, I think, an unanswered question, and this is supposed to be a Socratic panel, so I'll ask a Socratic question. What is the nature of the ICANN organization? And I believe that was set up in number 3 of the straw man.
Right.
Is indeed ICANN a regulatory agency dealing with discrete technical issues?
Right.
Or is ICANN the governance or a proposed governance of the Internet?
Right.
And some of the baggage that entails?
Right.
The question of what or who is a member or how those members are structured or how they're elected, I think, actually hinges on that understanding.
Yes.
On the nature of the beast.
Yes.
You can try and answer the question of what is its nature by defining the membership. If
right.
you define the membership, to some extent you've defined its nature. But it's not necessarily the most efficient way of determining its nature.
Right.
If you could determine the nature of what we're trying to do, then these questions would answer themselves.
Right.
I think the difficulty we're having in answering these questions is we haven't stepped back and resolved that first question.
Right.
What are we trying to accomplish?
Well, notice, I think the point is really well taken. And indeed, there is not consensus, I think, complete consensus at least, on the issue of ICANN as custodian. We come in, we turn on the lights in the morning, when it gets dark, we turn off the lights and we leave, and that's all we're doing, so nothing to see here, folks. On one poll, and the other poll of ICANN as internet governance, and people fond say, no, they're not governing, they are merely doing X, Y, and Z. And I agree that straightening that out has to be a predicate to figuring out what kind of membership you want. And we have some guidance in the documents, the bylaws of ICANN, the agreements between ICANN and the government. We have thoughts that can be offered by some of the people within the ICANN governance scheme right now. But the thought this morning also is to say, before getting into that, and I understand there's a horse and cart problem, but before getting into that, are there ways in which we can think about problems faced by organizations as they have internal or external battles that certain structures have solved or not? And I agree that in some ways that's why we structured a panel without necessarily regard to all the panelists being experts on ICANN or internet issues and left ample time in the afternoon for thinking more about the membership in relation to what ICANN is supposed to do. But that said, why don't we, unless there are other thoughts, Johan, if you identify yourself again and
Thank you.
How you'd like to contribute.
Yes, my name is Johan Hjelm. I work for a company called Ericsson. We manufacture communications equipment. I'm also a visiting engineer at the W3C, and I work a lot with an organization called the WAP Forum, which both of those are standardization organizations, so they are a little bit different from this forum. But what struck me here, and what Mitchell, if you take it one step further, what he's saying, is that if you look in the papers we've got, there is a rather definite goal for ICANN. It's to oversee and administer a set of functions. So what are these? We have 9 members appointed by the organizations who essentially provide these functions today. The question then is what these other 9 members are supposed to do, and in my view they are supposed to check on the other 9, which come from the companies who actually provide these functions. And that, I think, is crucial when you try to determine the membership that is to appoint these 9 members. Now, that said, I'm also not only working for all these organizations, I also happen to be Swedish, which puts me in a rather different position from most of you in this room. This, in my view, is unfortunately, even though it says a lot of nice things about internationalization in the papers, a lot of the discussion has been extremely US-centric, both the public discussion that has gone before and not so much the discussion that has happened here yet, but there's always that very big risk. Now, we have fairly good international representation here, but not on the panel. And I think that's something you really have to watch out for. The US may be the, in number of users, largest country on the internet as of now. However, in Scandinavia, the internet penetration is up to 50% of the population, even though the countries are smaller. That's something to take into account. And what happens when the Chinese get on there? I mean, there are a billion of them. It doesn't take very high penetration to be more than the entire population of the US. All these aspects have to be weighed in when you appoint the membership. Now, my particular get on that is that the chapters organization may work well in Anglo-Saxon countries, does not work well in other countries, especially not, and this is important, if the people who are officers of the chapters are the same as are working in the organizations that the chapters are supposed to oversee. I can discuss this with Scott later. It doesn't work well in Sweden at all, for instance. So there are a few observations that I think we should try to take into account in the future.
Any thoughts from the board here, the panel?
Don't do that.
I said the panel, and I corrected myself.
Don't do that to us. Two specific notes. One is, in the Internet Society, there are actually more chapters outside the U.S. than there are inside, by quite a bit. The chapter program was actually started at the request of the non-U.S. members to make it so that they could focus on the local issues rather than something in far-off Washington trying to get their attention. So, and that, plus the fact that actually at the moment more than half the members of the individual members of the Internet Society are non-U.S. So it's not an undoable thing to worry about that non-U.S. membership.
I wanted to just say that INTA has about half of its membership that are non-U.S. members, and it's, I think, a problem that they're grappling with right now. The association was formerly the United States Trademark Association, and about 6 years ago it became the International Trademark Association. What they've tried to do over the past 5 or 6 years is, while there's no difference in the fees charged or they don't really get special perks for international members, they do try to have their annual meetings in other countries. They're trying to do things like they used to refer to the membership as domestic and foreign, and now they're referring to it as non-U.S. Just little things to try to make international members feel more comfortable and more welcome with the association.
Michael Sundown.
Yeah, I just want to note that I was cut off. I did have something significant and important to say, and I think that's the whole quality of what's happening, that there's a distortion of what the U.S. government's role in this is, and therefore a suppression of, in fact, the real issues that have to be brought up
we should add to
people
this,
of the public question.
Thank you, Rhonda. We should add to this, there's a paper by Rhonda that she submitted to this session that is available downstairs. We've made copies. We'll not be invoicing you for that. And welcome you to get back in line again for another bit of something to say. So, Michael.
May I address that governance question that was brought up a little earlier and discussed for
sure.
A moment? Just very briefly?
Yes, go ahead.
I don't think anybody has a very good sense yet of what the Internet is going to become in 10 years from now. That's not a long time, 10 years, but it's a long time out for the Internet. And there's nobody who can project, I don't think at this point, what the international global influence of that sort of fast, cheap communication is going to eventually be. As a result of the potential for the Internet to change the way of life for human beings on this planet, I think we have to assume that it will influence how human beings govern themselves. It might not, but it could. And because it has the potential to do that, we have to create a structure for assuming that responsibility. If we try to avoid that, structures will arise that haven't been planned, and they could become dangerous. We have to protect the Internet from that happening. And we have a great responsibility. And if we try to avoid it, we are simply allowing it to occur in an uncontrolled way. There is no way conceivable that ICANN can avoid becoming involved in governance. And everybody, the quicker that's accepted and understood, the faster we'll arrive at some way of doing that.
So before letting the panel react, let me just ask you, Michael, a similar question to the one I asked Rhonda, which is, assuming, even if you don't agree with it, that the functions that may grow into or actually be, even at the moment, governance, are to be exercised, overseen by ICANN, not by government, assuming that fact. What do you think is the most important...
I'm sorry.
What do you think is the most important thing to structure in a membership to actually make membership responsive and able to not allow an unjust policy that may govern it or the Internet at large to come about?
Well, a number of people have said that potentially everyone in the world is a potential user of the Internet. I think that has to be taken into consideration. As the man from the Nordic countries has pointed out, that potential is being realized very quickly in some places. And there could be huge leaps if the government of China, for example, took a slightly different approach. And that's a decision that could be made since it's a dictatorship from one day to the next. We might find that two years from now, there were 50 million people added to the Internet users from China. I mean, that's a possibility. Anything could happen. We don't know how this is going to grow. So we have to assume that the entire world makes up the potential membership of ICANN. What we're basically faced with here is trying to figure out how to create representativity structures for the entire human species. That's something that's never been really dealt with. We've thought about world government. Its projects have been attempted. The United Nations is one of them, et cetera, et cetera. We are confronted with that. I don't think there's anybody in this room who hasn't thought about that problem, that question. That is the reality that we are confronted with. And I think if we don't discuss it in those terms, we are not going to deal with it in a practical way.
Thank you. Reactions from the panel? Teresa, did you have something?
I think
both Michael and Rhonda have raised excellent points, because typically, and I stress Rhonda's point, is the notion that having governance over public assets, and typically nonprofit corporations or 501c3s are not the vehicle for having governance over public assets. And so it's very important that when we talk about membership, we are thinking it's not necessarily members of typical 501c3 corporations, but something more like citizens, citizen users, citizen potential users, because a number of people are not yet users but will become, as Michael pointed out. And so if this entity is going to have some kind of legitimacy, it has to talk about creating governance structures that are responsive. And I think Michael's point that we have to talk about that first, otherwise you're going to have other entities that will be created that will have much more legitimacy.
I just want to add one word.
Go ahead.
I forgot. I think that it seems to me that, you know, if government has shown itself, and it's had the opportunity, it did create the internet in a sense. It was created through a method of using government agencies to provide services and funding for it. And if the government had shown itself, the U.S. government or whatever government, capable of taking on the responsibility of governing the internet, perhaps there wouldn't be any need for us to be here. But the simple fact is government has not shown itself capable of accepting that responsibility and carrying it out, and it is not willing to do that.
Yeah.
So government, I mean, isn't that the simple practical
situation? It does highlight between you and Rhonda the idea that you both agree the crown jewels are there, they need to be guarded, and one says it's got to be government that guards it, and the other says, you know, government has somewhat abdicated. All right, I will not. Yes, please, Fred, go ahead.
In response to Michael's presentation, Michael, I don't know you, but I don't know your last name either, so I'll call you Michael. Under your proposition, I have to change my position when I said that I would not be a member of ICANN, because one proposition simply says, by light of the fact that I have a domain name or I'm a user of the internet, I'm a member. That everyone who uses, certainly I have a stake in whatever the decisions are that are going to be made here. So one way of looking at this, which relates to what I said a little bit before, is everyone's a member if you're thinking of this in terms of whose interests are involved. And the membership you're about to create are really the activists, the people who are going to spend their time working out the power relationships and the decisions with this organizing board. And I want to, I would hope that one is sure that all three parts of this world are represented in the structure that is being created, that this is not just an interrelationship between the board and what you have been describing as members, but rather recognizing that I have a right as a non-board member, non-member, but user, to make sure my interests, and of course Michael has made clear this is worldwide, my interests are being represented in the decisions that are being made here, and that could get lost in the battle between a board and the kind of membership that you're assuming.
Or it could be folded into a discussion of, if it's Michael's vision that we see for ICANN, can you make a membership that is everybody? I mean, then it becomes semantics. If everybody is able to be the member, then it's okay to have the membership be the vehicle, because after all, there's no barrier to entry. But then you even get into, do you have to fill out the form? Do you have to pay a fee? Do they come
I'm
look for
sure
you?
I'm not sure it's semantics, however.
Yeah. Mitchell, did you still have something? And then Esther.
If you take the premise that this is a regulatory agency, and it's probably the most sensible way to approach this, it certainly looks like a regulatory agency. It is a regulatory agency with a very peculiar nature. It has no logical ownership, unlike almost any other regulatory agency you can imagine. So you then need to come up with owners, and that is what I think we're doing in the search for membership. Since it's a free-floating agency, you need to figure out how to resolve disputes. So some part of this is going to have to involve a dispute resolution process. And it's going to need leadership, which will be that, under this structure, then the 19th vote on the board, whatever, you know,
right,
the chairman.
Right.
And if that doesn't look like a legislature, a judiciary, and an executive director, Ms. President.
No, that's Mike Roberts.
Then I don't know what does.
Right.
So I think it comes back to governance, whether you take the left or the right fork.
Right. Esther.
I want to say three things very briefly. First of all, I do hope the board doesn't turn into one power block against another, the nine at large versus the nine others. Second, I want to agree with almost all of what Michael Sandow said, although I will draw some different conclusions from it. And the first thing, everybody talks about the internet, and if you ask almost anybody, the first thing they'll say about it is dynamic, it is changing. As not executive director, but as interim chairman of ICANN, I can stick around for a maximum of 2 years. And I am personally very, very grateful. I have no delusions that I and the initial board can do what Michael said, which is to plan and create something that will last forever as we planned it. All we can try to do is to build a structure that can evolve. And if we try and set, I mean, even if what we are talking about in the fullness of time is a world government, if we try and set up a world government now, we will fail. What we're trying to build is a flexible structure to take on some duties, powers, responsibilities. We are not a regulatory board, and the reason is we don't have the authority to regulate. The fact is we have to go out and make contracts with these people that supposedly we're going to be regulating. We hope to establish ourselves as a generally accepted group that can do that with more credibility and legitimacy over time. But we can't construct this thing all in one piece. And this initial board was not elected. Everybody knows that. That's a very important fact. So we have to build a structure whereby a board can legitimately be put in place by stakeholders. And we need to do that carefully without arrogating inappropriate power, without misunderstanding the limits of what we can do. And so what we want to do is build an evolving system that can adapt to the changes as they occur. And we're trying not to be disingenuous. We're trying to be humble and understand the limits of our role.
Reactions at all from the panel?
I see no prior models that really match this very well. And so you have a unique set of problems and issues that go way beyond the notion of democracy and have to do much more with power and bootstrapping. And I'm just sitting back here thinking what comes closest to this, and nothing is coming to mind. So I think that's going to be your greatest challenge.
Yeah, it's funny, because we've been collectively, as we've been trying to do the study, thinking about the same question. Is there an example of a private, nonprofit organization holding a public trust that, for which the decisions of the organization don't just affect, you know, an opera house deciding what opera to put on or a charity deciding where to give its money, but decisions that...
You're a little bit like a utility that has some monopolistic powers. You're
right.
A bit like the telephone company, but that changed. And
right.
So every model I start to think about
right.
isn't quite...
The closest thing I can think of is the American Bar Association, which is a private, nonprofit membership organization that relates to the selection of federal judges in a way that if the ABA says they don't like you, you don't become a federal judge. And that's a way of having public input that is exclusive to that organization. But you're right, it's a hard question, and actually a question just to put out. To think about is, do we have examples not just of membership organizations facing certain issues, but ones for which there's some notion of public trust or a central facility?
My sense is that that however you structure it as far as the distribution of power within the organization, the real issue is how much power can you keep and how much, I mean, that to me is ultimately right. going to be your main issue. I don't think that the structure of the organization is going to answer that.
Right. Charlie.
I go back to the formation document that we're working under. My own sense of the document was that it was quite brilliant.
This is the white paper you're talking about?
No, this is
the bylaws?
This is the ICANN Articles of Incorporation. This is the structure that was presented, which is essentially bicameral in its, at least its apparent design, that has nine board members who are to come up through associations of stakeholders, as far as I can tell, and it looks to me like the group that in some sense is to represent, at least this is the way I've thought of it, is to represent the interests that have more or less got us here, coming to where we are today. We seem to be beneficiaries of this most remarkable technological development that suddenly presents us with this grand new problem. And the associations, at least in my sense of the document, represent the, or should represent the forces in some sense that brought us here. Then there are the nine at-large members, which at this point we have initial directors who were simply chosen. But they're chosen in a way as placeholders, as people who are to start us down the path. And the challenge that's in front of us is to define some way of replacing them, which leads to a sense of legitimacy. So if I ask the question, how would we gauge success at the end of our membership study effort, I would say that success would be gauged if the nine people who are chosen to replace the initial at-large directors are generally widely accredited, seen as people who truly have the at-large internet community at heart. That to me, that suggests an at-large community of the future, not simply United States, not simply the people who are presently on the net, but somehow people who truly represent the future at-large community of the internet. So that's a credibility problem. It's a legitimacy problem. I answer Michael's question as to what we're about. My sense is that's what we're about. What ICANN will be doing, whether it's regulatory, whatever it's doing, it's going to be doing something that's very important to the internet community at large. And if we wind up in a structure, I don't see these groups as oppositional. I don't see the stakeholders as somehow opposed to the internet community at large. But I do see groups that have interests on the one hand that are more specific than the at-large community, and then another group that sees itself in some sense as representing the future. So for me, the challenge is how do you create a method of choosing nine people who will be credible to the at-large, to everyone, as representing, having, you may disagree with them, but you ideally would credit the idea that they're thinking and acting and making their judgments in terms of the best interest of the whole internet community. Now,
should we let the board react to that? Or
yeah, that'd be great. Sure.
Okay. What's that? Yes. Panel. Why do I keep saying board? Panel.
Because you're trying to short circuit the process.
Yes, of course. And my conspiracy almost worked too.
I want to push back just a touch on what Charlie just said. You said something about that the supporting organizations were broad in some way, and being somebody who was playing with a couple of those, actually were viewing them as more, like say, practitioners of the art, and looking to the at-large board of ICANN, at-large board members of ICANN, to represent the view that you were just speaking of, the global internet view, but to not specifically think that that will also come in through the practitioners of the art of IP address assignment or domain names, because those are relatively specialized interests. Some history on this, going back quite a ways, back 3 years now, I guess. As a board member of one of the IP address registries, ARIN, I, along with the other IP address registry people, approached John Postel, suggesting that we couldn't rely on John forever, and we needed to set up some kind of way to proceed into the future with IP addresses and domain names and protocol assignments and the such. And we suggested that we break them into three separate organizations, completely separate organizations, one dealing with domain names, one dealing with protocols, and one dealing with IP addresses. John pushed back on us, saying that he didn't think there was enough there to achieve escape velocity, is the way he put it. But there's more to it than that, and John was right, that there wasn't the right thing to do to break them up. Because the thing that he didn't think of at the time and we didn't think of at the time was that the domain name people and the IP address people are viewing the world through very narrow focus. They're worrying about their particular problem. The IP address people are worried about the exhaustion of IP addresses and the exhaustion of space in the routers to make sure the internet keeps working. And so at this point, I would say, as one of the people involved, we've probably overcorrected. And we're being a little bit over ambitious about being careful. There's a representation of the rest of the world that needs to come into this. And that was what none of us had when we looked at this 3 years ago, and that's what ICANN does have. It's got a method by which, when the IP address people come up with a set of policies to try and do what they're supposed to do, which is to preserve the scarce resource, that there's a pushback to say that don't be selfish, look at these other issues. And I think that's a tremendously important thing. But to try and do it in a way that makes the assumption that the supporting organizations will in of themselves have this extra view in it is unrealistic, because these are very sophisticated technical issues and do have to be vetted in a larger way. So I think it is very important to have this pushback, this separate group.
Can I just come back with and forth a little bit with Scott?
Okay.
So I'm not sure that you and I are disagreeing, Scott. My sense of it is that there was a fear at the idea that somehow we were going to open up the subject matter here to at large, because they're not engineers. They'll screw it up. If you wind up with people saying you should do things that can't be done, the whole thing crashes. So on the one hand, you've got a group of people whose concern is this thing has actually got to run. And on the other hand, you've got a group of people who are your broader constituency. Am I off on the way you're seeing it?
Because actually it came from the other end. It came from the narrow view. It came from the restricted view of not having the public voice in there, to not have the at-large voice in there, and has migrated to one to have the at-large voice in there.
Losing the engineers voice.
Without losing the engineers, and doing it in a way which allow the engineers to make a statement, a technology statement, if they need to. So it didn't start off with the option was do something in a public way and put the engineers under it. It actually started with the engineers were going to do it by themselves.
Right.
And the picture that came out of ICANN is much more inclusive and better.
And so the challenge is for the nine at large to represent that public voice.
Right. On that point, one of the critical issues is going in relationship to reaching that goal is going to be not just the question of who elects these board members, but how do they become candidates? What's the nomination process? a traditional establishment, old world order nomination process is some form of nominating committee. Nominating committees can be a form of self-perpetuation. At Common Cause, part of what they did was add diversity and balance and lots of things that people were worried about, in part because there was a mandate to the nominating committee in the bylaws and structure of the kind of goals to be achieved in the nominating process. There was also, and in most cases are, an outlet system for petition candidates, so that a nominating committee and a nominating process gives a tilt in the process. But it also helps to meet, can help to meet and carry out organizational goals and give people some sense. It gives an edge, but it also could help in reaching the goal of getting a credible board that represents an at-large community. And then, of course, if a nominating committee or some kind of nominating forum makes sense, then you get to the question of who's going to choose the nominating committee. But that could be a central role in all of this.
That's actually one of the breakout sessions just after lunch is exactly on that question. Mitchell, did you have something to say before we...
Yes. I wanted first off to make sure that I made the announcement that, in fact, the Association of Internet Professionals did file an application for an organization of one of the DNS, or of the DNSO, just so that there's no agendas I'm keeping under the table. Yeah, we all know it is a conspiracy. So I just wanted to put that on the table. And I think what is implied in this discussion bears very directly on this, that the nine members, if the DNSOs or if the SOs represent what you might call the insiders of the industry, the people who are stakeholders, then the other nine need to represent, humanity, let's call it, which is a truly appallingly large concept. But I think that it certainly is the logical outcome. And I did want to suggest that there is one model that I've met that functions somewhat like this, and that's the model of community media, or even particularly community radio, where you have a defined environment with many stakeholders, with a public right involved. And a lot of what I see going on here is an awful lot like what I used to see going on when I was deeply involved in community radio. It's a lot like trying to negotiate, the owners of the poker show versus, the owners of, the disco show.
Right.
So you might take a close look at some of the dispute resolution right. that happens in that environment.
You've just marked the era in which you were a community radio person.
Yes.
I should just alert people, we're slated to stop at 11:15, and I'd like to be sure that we get everybody that's in line right now. Yes, Scott.
I think I should answer Rhonda's question about what the initial dispute was in the Internet Society, because it is instructive, and I don't want to leave
I think its value as an example may be lost, given...
Well, the fundamental was that there were procedures put in place in the Internet Society Board as in an attempt to introduce stability, to ensure stability. And that involved having particular nailed down board seats. And after the initial period of operation, some of the board members, some of the people in those seats or some of the organizations sponsoring those seats were less happy than others with letting go. And the caution here is that putting in specific policies for an initial period of operation to ensure stability can come back and bite you pretty good after that initial period is done. And the fight was over getting rid of those, quote, stability options.
Well, it's interesting because some of the discussion here has been about whatever membership structure may shake out of this whole process, and ultimately it rests in the hands of the ICANN board, subject to how the public and others may react. Whatever shakes out, the thought has been, since it's such terra incognita, wouldn't we want to have it be tentative? These are the rules for just the next year or just the next
very
election.
Reason I brought that up.
And then build it into the system to revisit it automatically so that you don't end up saying, oh, we blew it, we should have done it this way around and that way, and now it's too late, the rules are there, the election happened, now they brought in a particular board and there's no way to go back.
I think it's a very important point, and my caution, based on the experience the Internet Society has, is to do it in a way which can be automatically or mandated to be automatically reviewed, rather than the way the Internet Society did it, which actually locked it in. We had to have unanimous consent of the affected for special board members to change
right.
their status, and they didn't give it.
Right. Jay Halbin.
Yes, I'm Jay Halbin. I'm a citizen of the United States. I try to be a netizen and also an editor of the Amateur Computerist. I welcome the fact that we're having a discussion. I think the main point for me as a citizen of the United States, I have the ability to participate. I think as a netizen, I have the ability to participate. I think the great thing about the Internet is that it's creating for us the possibility of participation. So I would like to interject that into the discussion, the possibility that we're not looking for representation. We're looking for a mechanism by which we facilitate participation of all the people that possibly can by spreading the Internet to all those people and then by protecting them by whatever due process is necessary so that their participation has a significance and is invited and examined for its value and not dismissed. Because if we get the input from the great majority of people around the world, the mix is a very difficult mix, but the outcome will be a much more powerful outcome. From my point of view, I think that's what democracy is. If you get all the inputs, you have a better chance of getting a successful output from that process. And I would like to suggest that there's a problem I see, and the problem I see is that all of the models are models that say you can't have an ITU or you can't have an FAA, you can't have government. But I think we have to be broader than that. We have to entertain the possibility that the solution to the problem we face is that the members of ICANN will be the governments of the world, and they'll participate as the representatives of the people, and the people will have due process and participation in that process. So that, in fact, we have to be careful not to lock in, even though we can accept the name ICANN, not to lock in that it has to be private, because it may be impossible to solve the problem of the immensity of the resources, the public nature of international communication. And so I have to ask, is there any possibility we can succeed if we don't entertain the possibility that the result is going to be that we understand the significance of the governments of the world playing the part of being the vehicles by which their people have the due process to participate in the process?
And imagine the governments as members.
Well, if you have to call them members, call them members.
Right.
I'm arguing against representation as the mechanism. We're not going to take a body of people to represent
right.
the great other people.
Right.
I'm saying that the people of the world have to participate, and their ability to participate has to be protected.
Right.
And so governments are the mechanisms, when they function properly, for that protection. I've protested my government's policies and all of my government's wars over the whole of my lifetime. That doesn't mean I succeed in moving them, but I have the right and I have the spirit and sometimes the protection to do that. I think that that's fundamental to build in, is the protection. So I disagree with Michael Sandel because I think the government did a wonderful job building the Internet. I think its mechanism of building it, of throwing money and encouragement at a bunch of wonderful people, did a tremendous job of stimulating basic research. The research led to experimentation, which led to success. It spread. The NSF picked up, it spread it further, it was spread to the world. The government did a tremendous job until recently. Recently it said, we want to control this subterraneously. We don't want the U.S. government to be obviously in control of this. We have to build a mechanism by which the government can do whatever control it needs to serve the military, whoever it serves, but not on the surface. And so it invented the green paper and white paper processes, which I'm arguing is a cover, and I'm against my government doing that. I will protest my government doing it. I will kick and bite and scream against them, but I value that I have a government to kick and bite and scream against, and I'm afraid if we don't build that government into this structure, then I won't have somebody to kick, bite, or scream against.
And no provision in a bylaw saying members have the right to kick, bite, and scream really approaches the natural rights you have vis-a-vis your government.
I think so, and I think that what I'm asking is that by having the governments involved in the overall protection of the global international communication, it gives me access to bite and scream and kick because I can do that to my government. That's built in already. I don't think ICANN can build in
right.
protecting my ability to bite it if I'm in Malaysia and ICANN is mostly in California or whatever.
Right. Reactions from the panel? Mindful again of the time? Anybody? No?
Just a note, historic note on this comment is that it was decided the wording in the ICANN bylaws about the non-direct participation of governments and people and governmental employees was put in by the U.S. government. The IRA magaziner, as part of the process, felt that this was a very important point. So it's in the bylaws now. It wasn't something that the geeks put in, but I will say the geeks right. didn't fight it.
Right. So you say the government made us do it, or made ICANN do it, and...
But let me just briefly respond. The U.S. Yeah. government has structures and mechanisms which deny the possibility of the executive branch delegating policy...
That's a different point. My point was, I was just clarifying the historical picture, not whether they have the right to do it.
Right, I understand that, but I think we can do something constructive by correcting the errors. I would ask us to correct the errors of my government. I'm sure people would like the errors of their governments corrected as well, but we don't have to take an error. The poison of a poison tree is poison fruit, and if they poisoned us, we don't have to swallow the poison. We can reject it and say, you've done something that's against your ability to do it, and we're not going to accept it and get into the same boat as you.
I don't see that we can say whether it's for or against their powers to do it. That's a different...
Well, their own inspector general said that they cannot delegate policy matters to private sector.
So self-correcting problem, then.
Thank you.
But I'm arguing we don't have to accept the mistake that the executive branch made and make it our banner and say we can't have governments because it said we can't have governments.
Right.
We'd better examine whether if without governments ICANN fails and there's no ICANN,
right.
then it doesn't make sense to carry on.
Thank you. Will Zachman.
Hi, Will Zachman, Canopus Research. Inspired by Mitchell's reference to Socratic questions, I'd like to try to see if I could bring us back to what I think is a kind of fundamental Socratic issue underlying this. I noted, if my memory serves me correctly, that there are at least a couple instances of members of the panel who identified themselves as now being associated with an organization that's involved in promoting democracy in some way, and I think there are at least a couple of them where it was stated that the organization itself had no voting members and essentially a closed, self-perpetuating board of directors. And I think that actually gets to a fundamental Socratic question. I very vividly remember that fundamental question being discussed within 20 minutes walking distance of right here in the spring of 1969. And in the language of the day, the debate was between the bottom-up power to the people and the necessity, some saw for the role of the vanguard of the proletariat during the spring of 69 in this neck of the woods. But the point has nothing to do with those specific organizations nor with that particular context of rhetoric, but with the basic issue, which is the tension, it seems to me, in any human organization, it's a sociological issue, really. In any organization, there is on the one hand clearly times where you want to have some kind of continuity and control in an organization, and that's in favor of some sort of very difficult to change, if you will, structure. I would note, though, also that it's inherent in any structure, any human organizational structure, that there is a built-in automatic conservatism to organized groups of human beings. Even in the most democratic of contexts, you know, a New England town meeting, the moderator of the town meeting, in fact, has substantial control, much as Jonathan does, not complete control, but considerable control of the context, even in a relatively democratic context.
That and 85 cents gets me to alewife.
And so there are times where you do want to have, for whatever reason, control from the top, and there is a natural tendency to maintain that control. On the other hand, I am operating on the assumption that this meeting would not be taking place today if there was not a concern with the other aspect of it, which is how do you have effective input and influence from some constituency that can flow into the organization as a whole. And it seems to me that's really the fundamental question that we're dealing with here. When I looked at the breakout groups, the obvious one was the membership one, but then as I thought about it, it struck me that the really intriguing one was this one about capture. because the approach of the material seems to be from a perspective, at least the sense I get of it, is a concern about the danger of capture, you know, it's the alarm of capture. Yet it seems to me that if the notion of having a broad base of membership and participation that has some influence has any significance at all, if it actually has any real meaning, then there must fund, what this is about is designing some sort of structure that allows for at least a limited capture under certain circumstances when necessary. Because if that's not what it's about, then what it's about is creating a self-perpetuating organization that is not going to be, I mean, if you can't, if the people can't overthrow the vanguard of the proletariat in that language that was so familiar to me in discussions with friends in the 60s, then there really isn't any point in talking about what the membership view is. So I would invite then, ask you as members of the panels, from this high Socratic perspective, to comment on what you, any of you, would wish to, on what you think is the, what you see as the key issues in this context in terms of what kind, what are the ways in which there is a broad consistency, how does it have to be represented, and how is it possible to actually have power to affect things without overturning the apple cart in the process?
Anybody want to take a crack at that? Teresa, and then Fred?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's kind of a narrow question to try to deal with. I mean, none of this is new, of course. This goes on in at every level in all any kind of organized structure, and it's the same questions being faced here. I mean, I do think that I put a great stake in the process of how you hold an organization accountable at the starting point, and then to the next stage, how you provide a system where people can genuinely get their points of view, their thoughts on the table, while recognizing that those who have the responsibility have to have the ability to decide and act and function. And that's a very tough balance. I mean, the battles over participation and input often turn into battles over my views versus yours. And if my views are accepted, I had great participation. If my views are rejected, this is a closed system in which people can't participate and get their voices heard. But before you get to that, this accountability question, to me, it feels central to this process. I mean, because I don't know that you're going to wind up with a board that simply represents the will of the world or the will of the users or the will of the membership, and I don't know whether that's really the best goal for an organization like this. This isn't a government. This isn't a world order, not yet, maybe someday. So then you get to the question of where is the accountability? And there, having a structure where people can vote someone out does help in accountability, even if the system is somewhat tilted towards the people who have leadership and power. To me, one of the great breakdowns in our own democracy is we seem to have lost that. We have a theoretical voting process in our elections for Congress, but it is almost impossible to remove people from office in reality. And I think we see that play out in the kind of representation we have. So the process of people being able to vote someone out is very powerful and very important. It's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily result in the structure being thrown up in the air for choice. The other thing that is unusual in this world, I said this before, is there is potential enormous power in terms of holding this board accountable through the use of information on the internet. That doesn't exist in other forms of organizational process, but is now going to exist in the future. Embarrassing information, information that shows that the leadership of this organization is causing problems, doing things wrong, undermining the rights of the group at large, has potential enormous power over the decision-making of this board. And I go back to what I said before about, which is a very small thing, the Common Cause board. The leadership of the organization had a lot of power and influence in the actions of the organization. Some activists felt very denuded in power and very weak. The exercise of activity gets people's attention. And we found ourselves as an organization paying attention because we couldn't afford not to. In this kind of situation, with what the communications that can take place, that to me is probably far more powerful in terms of day-to-day accountability than any of these structure questions will be as the organization goes on. I think you have a built-in, much more powerful system of accountability from the outset than most organizations in the old world order ever face.
This was a suggestion of one government person that said, look, we had Sub Rosa, we don't need to have a direct role because if the thing gets too out of whack, why, we'll march right in and fix it because we'll be watching it. It also suggests that the session on capture, the breakout session soon to come, may have an interesting counterpart within it to think about, you know, capture, threats, and countermeasures, and maybe you have liberation means and methods. The idea that it's one thing to have the stable organization captured by a minority group of interests intent on just working the levers. It's another to imagine the organization there but drifting in the wrong direction and able to liberate it through some means to kind of shake it up a little bit. Therese had something to say, and then Mitchell quickly, and then we should get to the other two people at the mic.
Highlighted some of the problems with the tension between a typical nonprofit corporation, the vehicle that we have here, and setting up a democratic system of governance. And so some of the things that I would suggest is that I think maybe the best thing that ICANN can strive for is having at least certain processes that are extremely transparent and the result being uncertain outcomes. And in order to structure a system that you allow your constituency, all internet users or potential users or worldwide, to control the membership of the board and to force the board to be able to vote on certain policies, going back to an idea mentioned earlier, at up or down on certain issues so that you know how the governing structure is operating, and actually much more transparency that is currently written into the bylaws.
Mitchell, for a brief comment, and then...
As the situation in Washington right now demonstrates, structure matters most when you're in failure mode, and that's what your structure should be built around solving. When things are working right, structure is not so important. When things are coming apart at the seams, if you don't have a good structure...
Well, you have a crucible. You have very strong battles to be fought.
If you don't have a good structure in place when things go bad, right, then you can go into catastrophic failure mode, and that gets ugly.
Right. Thank you. Daniel.
Hi, I'm Daniel Kaplan. As a member of the Membership Advisory Committee, I feel helped by the beginning of that morning because we started talking about democracy and asking ourselves what the demos is and then what the pressure is. And that helps because obviously, for example, if you say our people is everyone in the world and then our power is any issue that can come about, then the only legitimate bodies are governments. So we have to find out which level of restriction of one or the other we have to reach. Then one of the very helpful things that I've heard from the table is the distinction between citizenry and membership. This is extremely important for ICANN because ICANN obviously has citizens, that is people it has some power of ruling on. You could argue it's all internet users. I would tend to argue it's at least all IP address owners and domain name holders. They have direct influence on them, so at least these people are the citizenship, citizenry. Now, maybe not all these people will join as members, because to become a member, you have to decide that you want to be a member. Or if you say it's the same, then you have the distinctions between passive members who don't exercise their voting rights and then active members, and it's the same problem. So that would come back to first a suggestion that we try to address that question, is there a distinction between citizenry and membership in the breakout sessions? And also for your survey, I don't think we'll have plenty of time to discuss it with the table, but in your survey, you could ask all membership organizations, why do people join? What's the reason? And then what's the interaction between the reason why people join and take part and the structure, decision structure, membership structure, etc., you have chosen? Because this is going to be crucial for us. If we want to understand what membership we want to build, we want to understand why will people decide that they're not only citizens, but members. Citizens is passive, members is active. Thank you.
Thank you. Any reactions from the panel?
The last comment, that citizens is passive and members are active.
Okay, for a last comment, and then I have afterwards a plan for how we can proceed to lunch.
Okay, yeah. First I need to respond to that. The whole point of citizens is active, if the sovereignty is to be with the citizen. So I think that that's what we're faced with. We're faced with substituting membership for citizenship. And on the internet there is a citizenship. That's what's made it work. And so what's been left out of this whole discussion are several things, but very important is the unique nature of the internet. It grew out of the protection of the U.S. government and other governments around the world, and that's very crucial to understand why it had to have that protection and what was the nature of that protection. And that had to do with keeping people who had self-interest, particularly in commercial or particular political agendas that would involve property and taking or gaining for their own profit-making purposes, that was restricted. And there was a good reason that was restricted. And so some of what's happening is the internet has been left out of this. The effect of having government and the U.S. and other governments around the world protect this development. And in fact, these are the crucial aspects of the internet. Who controls them controls the internet, all its users, all its future users. And so to deny those crucial questions from the crucialness, and to talk about membership, I'm not a member of any organizations in general, because somebody's controlling them and it's not the members. There's no organization I know where the members really have an ability to deal with the power plays that go on. And so you're taking the internet out from where it's been protected, putting it into a place where, in fact, the very thing that has to be protected against is the main aspect. And what's important here is that the U.S. government claimed it was going to give it to the private sector. That left out the public. What's really important is they didn't write the open document that they did with regard to that. They wrote the document as a design and test document with the government as a 50% piece. And if you don't know what governments are doing openly, the citizens, nobody can deal with them. Then we're really in trouble. And that's what's happened with this whole ICANN process up to now. So it's very, very important that government role, that's necessary role, be understood and put in. And in fact, the Inspector General's report of February 7, 1997 needs to be examined very carefully by anyone who's concerned about what should really be happening. And then the second thing is that the internet and what has made it possible for the internet to grow and flourish has to be examined. And then the third piece is that there are interests that are all vying to make their profits for various reasons. And that's the last thing these central functions need, and that's where this whole process is putting the internet into. And so that's a disaster. So something's gone wrong already, that this is happening, that the questions are being narrowed down to what aren't the essential questions.
Thank you. Just 30 seconds.
My name is Izumi Ais. I'm from Tokyo, but living in Malaysia. And just point of clarification to Londa that some governments, I'm not an American citizen, so I don't care about the American government, you define, have suppressed the growth of the internet. They didn't protect. And they changed their policy that now they're trying to promote. These are some of the facts, be it in Japan or China or in Vietnam. Thank you.
Okay. For a final, very brief comment, David.
A very brief question specific to membership organization. Ms. Smith, I'm curious if you could address why in the INTA there's not a single individual member, and whether or not you felt that the membership was representative of the trademark holder's interest, or whether or not the fee that was applicable may have been the inhibitor there. Thank you.
I can say that there are no individual people who are members, but there are individual law firms who are members, the law office of
Christie Parker and Hale.
Exactly. So I cannot address why no individuals have joined. I don't think that the fee for an individual, it's actually our regular member fee is $800, but for any corporations, firms, or associations which make under $100 million gross per year, the fee is cut in half, so it's $400. Excuse me. So perhaps, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So here's how we'd like to proceed, mindful of the hour. As you know, what follows after lunch are these breakout sessions. Topic one is who is or should be a member of ICANN. Tamar Frankel has agreed to lead that session. That's in Austin North. As you go down the stairs and face forward towards the food, Austin North is that room straight ahead. The next session is Capture, Threats and Countermeasures, and perhaps Liberation as well. That's in Austin West. My compass is correct. That puts it over there on the first floor again, this part of the building though. That's being led by Wendy Seltzer and Kim Isbell. And then the third session is How Should Directors Be Nominated and Elected? That's in Austin East, which is the room on that end on the first floor, being led by Diane Cabell. And what I'd like to suggest right now is first take a quick straw poll just to see how evenly distributed we are among those groups. How many people are intending to go to who is or should be a member of ICANN? Okay. How many people are intending to go to the Capture and Liberation one? Okay. How many people for How Should Directors Be Nominated and Elected? Great. That's a fairly even distribution by my lights. What I'd like to suggest then, actually, is that we, when we recess here, we actually go down, go to the rooms, meet your moderators, and spend 5-10 minutes just going over what you'd like to accomplish when you really meet, just sort of setting an agenda for what you'd like to do and see if there's an understanding within the group of what you'd like to cover and not. And after that, plan to just adjourn out of those rooms into lunch or a break, as you choose, starting at 12. So that'll put us right back on schedule again. Lunch will be from 12 to 1. And in the meantime, though, if you can proceed right now to those rooms just to get oriented if you want to contribute again to the agenda, that'll get you set for lunch at 12 and then the breakout sessions. Please join me in thanking the panel for their participation today. Everything. It's just right in the lobby.